now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. This week, I am exceptionally excited, as you can imagine, not just because Alison Rudd is back, but making his return after a 10-year hiatus, maybe longer, mostly for religious reasons, as he retreated to, was it Kerala, where you've been doing yoga for the last 10 years?
Yes.
It's Mr. Bill Edgar. Later on, we're going to be joined by another numbers guru, Duncan Alexander, who you may know from Opta. He runs the Opta Joe account. I spoke to him about how Opta works, about his new book, Outside the Box, which kind of tells the history of Opta and collecting numbers in football. And also, I asked him about Allison's favorite stat, expected goals. But first, there's only one place to start in this week, and that's at Stamford Bridge. Allison, Chelsea take on Manchester City. It's a heavyweight clash. It's, some people would say, City's first big away test this season. Forget the scoreline. They clearly won this, yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a strange game in many respects. I think it's hard to see this game in a perspective that isn't about Chelsea, to be honest, because I felt their approach played into City's hands. Not entirely sure why Conte was so deeply conservative. Chelsea played very deep. They didn't target any possible weak areas. I mean, you know, Delph, although he played well, he wasn't really asked any questions. There were lots of personnel mysteries, but one of them was, why didn't you play Victor Moses and attack Delph down the left? I mean, why don't you do that? Instead, they just left him alone. The mindset seemed to be one of, golly, you know, they've had a day extra rest. They haven't had to travel. They're in good form. Let's just, you know, soak it up. Maybe try and get a draw out of this. I'm not quite sure if you're the champions of England, that's the right approach. It seemed peculiar. Chelsea would just retreated. And their game was built around getting the ball to Morata. And Morata's very good at holding the ball up. Morata goes off injured.
Well, we'll get there. We got time to spare on this.
I know, I'm making a list of things. But my basic point to start this off is it's about Chelsea's approach rather than City's brilliance, because City have an array of great attacking talent. We knew that. Surely it was about how Conte approached that fact, and he didn't approach it terribly well.
All right, I'll make the Conte counter argument.
Yes.
Because I'm fairly sure this is what he was thinking. The Atletico Madrid game took a lot out of them mentally, just with the late goal and whatnot. He was deeply concerned about City's ability to keep the ball and move the ball in midfield. He had somebody watch the Shakhtar Donetsk game, the first 45 minutes, where they kind of picked their spots in terms of counterattacking quickly, which helped nullify City's press, really for the first time, I think, this season. And he figured that Morata, you know, with the high line, you can say, well, but, you know, he didn't get anywhere with it. Yeah, but, you know, it only takes one mistake from Stones or Otamendi, one mistake or indeed one perfectly timed move from Morata to send him through on goal. I think it was that, plus Hazard running at people, win set pieces. You've got a much bigger team with Alonso, Bakayoko, Rudiger, Christensen, Cahill, and Morata. That was the logic behind him. Question is, why didn't it work? Was it because City were just better? Bill?
I think City were a lot better, yeah. Really, I think the game, it was more about what City did, really. I would say one...
Interesting. Sorry if I can just flag up.
We have a difference of opinion.
We have a difference of opinion. Allison says it's more about Chelsea and what they did wrong, and you're saying it's more about City and what they did right.
So you've got to say it's about the referee then. Clearly. But the one thing about Chelsea, I would say that they played N'Golo Kanté further forward than he's accustomed to. If he was alongside Bakayoko as a definite two defensive midfielders, that would have reduced the space for Silva and De Bruyne, certainly. But he played a bit further forward, surprisingly. Aside from that, Man City got their closing down spot on the entire team. It was like watching Barcelona, at least in terms of defending. It was like watching Barcelona about 2010, 2011, that sort of era. Because Chelsea, just every time they got the ball, they had two or three players closing down on them, and all the options they had for passes, all their teammates were closed down as well. So they would have had to play exceptionally well, and occasionally they will do, but they would have had to play exceptionally well to get past that, and they just couldn't do. If City can play like that for the whole season, then they're going to get 90 points and almost certainly win the league. Whether they can, I'm not sure. I guess that's what Guardiola has been trying to do since he arrived at City.
Isn't the argument that then why be conservative with Alonso? And I mean, if you are being pressed that way, one way to counter it is send your wing backs further up, send Alonso and Azpilicueta further forward. Is that a mistake Conte made?
Well, I guess Conte was surprised that City played that well. I mean, City just generally don't play that well defensively, closing teams down. It was a surprise that they were doing that at the start of the game, and he was probably thinking maybe City would tire and eventually Chelsea's game plan would work out okay, so perhaps he should have changed things after an hour. But with City, on top of their great defensive display, on the attack, City got De Bruyne and Silva, so normally one player like that, they're both absolute title-winning players, one player like that is a gift for any team, but to have two players like that, both in the centre as well, the way City set up, they've got one defensive midfielder and two just ahead of them, and then three forwards beyond them, including two wingers. So they've got these two unbelievably good attacking midfielders in the centre. So you can't really man mark them. You'd need two man markers to stop that. And once you start go to two man markers, your game plan is really restricted.
Conte made a big deal out of the fact that we had to go play away from home on a Wednesday, and they played at home on a Tuesday.
Negative reinforcement, that's what that is.
It's interesting. I always wondered about the psychology, you know, and does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy when people come out and say stuff like that?
Obviously, he's been saying it lots. Too much, I think. He's been banging on about it for weeks and weeks.
Well, it's curious because I know a guy who is a professional gambler, and he's got a whole army of eggheads who do this very advanced statistical modeling. He's been doing it a long time, and he makes enormous amounts of money doing it. And he's had studies specifically on the impact of an extra day's rest versus not having it. And he says there's basically no difference whatsoever, at least in terms of outcomes and results.
Is that once there's a 3-day gap, say Wednesday to Saturday, that's fine. But if it's Thursday to Saturday, or you know, a 2-day gap.
Well, he looked at the difference in rest between the two sides, right? So
between a 3-day gap and a 4-day gap, let's say.
No. Between Allison played on Wednesday and you played on Tuesday, and you guys face each other on Saturday, yeah. Right? So it's the gap between the two teams, not necessarily between the last two games. And it really was it's statistically insignificant. And he looked at a database of, you know, 10,000 games or whatnot. And yet, managers keep coming back to it. And I wonder if maybe they change the way they prepare as a result. I do have to say, I don't know what the rest of the City team did. I'm assuming they didn't go with Aguero to Amsterdam to watch a concert. But if one of those days they had entirely off and they weren't actually preparing for the Chelsea game, did it really make that much of a difference?
It felt like Conte had diluted all that adoration and adulation and praise that came their way for their result against Atletico. I mean, there was a whole raft of, wow, you know, English football's back in Europe. We could actually win the Champions League this year.
Play really, really well against Atletico.
So what do you do with that? That's a really important thing to go into a game against City. We are potentially the best team in Europe right now. You can build on that. Instead, Conte just kept bleating on about how they've had longer to rest than we have. I just think psychologically, and it's harder to measure those psychological things, but the vibe around Chelsea was one of being miffed as opposed to feeling superior. And then if you add to that the fact that their lineup was one of deference, I feel, to City rather than trying to find weak spots, I feel if you could go back in time and change the way you approach that game, Chelsea could have won it.
I think it's pretty simple. I don't know if it was necessarily one of deference, but against a team that presses the way they do when you don't have David Luiz. And again, I think Christensen's actually so good on the ball that I don't think there's much difference between him and Luiz in terms of the ball, but Conte obviously doesn't feel that way. I think he felt when you play City, who are, you know, are going to press you, he felt he needed to have Cesc Fabregas in the team. And he felt he needed to have somebody, and the reason by Azpilicueta played on the flank, again, is I want to have another guy who's comfortable on the ball, certainly more comfortable than Victor Moses, if I need to retain possession and stuff like that. And if you put Cesc in the team, you either play Cesc and Conte, in which case you're asking Conte. I know there's two of them, but you're still asking them to single-handedly try to keep De Bruyne and the other maniac at bay. You stick Bakayoko in, and at that point, you have to sacrifice one of your strikers. I don't know. I wish he would have looked at other stuff, like maybe this might have been a game for a back four.
Absolutely, a game for a back four. Why play three at the back when you're marking one centre forward? Complete waste of personnel, isn't it?
It's just one centre forward because Sané and Sterling come at you too. But yeah, I think this could have been a game where, I think, with the right comfort levels, he could have done
and
that.
And what a surprise, you know. I don't think City were given anything to worry about.
On the other hand, you go Christensen and Cahill, and you lose, and people tell you what a dope you are. You know, so I think there's a lot of things that Conte could have done better, but by the same token, I just think you really have to doff your cap to the Pep. One final thing on this point. There's a line which Conte's camp love putting out, and obviously it goes back to the summer and stories again about him leaving at the end of the season, that Chelsea's squad is just too thin and too weak relative to City's. And I think it's kind of hard to divorce the personnel from the way they play, because especially because City's style is so distinctive. Is Chelsea's squad really that much weaker than City's when you go through it? I mean, if you ask me Courtois versus Ederson, I'll take Courtois every day of the week. Kyle Walker's been playing well, but he's still Kyle Walker. Otamendi and Stones versus Chelsea center backs. Again, I certainly don't see a big gap there. In fact, I think Chelsea center backs are probably better. Alonso for this system is Mendy's fantastic, but Mendy's not there. You know, where you get into a difference is, like you said, going forward, perhaps where they've got many more options and better options.
Yeah, Man City, you've got great options going forward, but still have Chelsea, Willian, Pedro, Hazard, Fabregas, all brilliant creative players. So I don't think there's a problem there. One thing you would say is that Chelsea only have one proper centre-forward, so when Morata...
What about Batsman?
You stopped me mentioning that at the very beginning.
Because I didn't want to bring out the Batsman, because he lurks in the shadows.
He doesn't hold the ball up well. Okay, I accept that. And Morata does. Morata goes off. You're not going to replace like for like if you bring the Batman on. For Morata, ooh, there's lots of tutters in there. But
By the way, I know Batman's much cooler, but when he sent that tweet out, he actually referred to himself as Batsman.
Which is better. I like that. But on so many levels, it gave off the message that, we've got nobody on the bench. And I don't know what it's saying about what Michy will now think for the rest of the season. He just had his confidence boost by scoring the winner in Spain, and you then turn around and say, you're just not good enough.
And it's such an obvious contrast with City, who lose Aguero for perhaps a couple of months, but they've got Jesus who can come in, and he's a ready-made centre-forward and will play there for the next 2 months.
Time now for our Goal of the Week segment. As you know, this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, and Europa League. Also, if you're into the FA Cup, the greatest cup competition in the world, so they tell me, from the third round. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. So with that in mind, Alison, I'm going to ask you, what was your favorite goal of the weekend in the Premier League? And I dare you to say Joselu.
I'm not going to say that. But Charlie, the producer, did asked me this question while I was eating a peach. And while I was eating the peach, Coutinho scored a peach of a goal. So it seemed like this was aligned in the stars. It was a beautiful goal. And he does have a sort of trademark way of curling it in. And I spent a lot of time over the past week talking about how when you watch Harry Kane, you sort of don't doubt he'll score. And I think Coutinho's a bit like that. You can just tell it's going to be beautifully placed, and it was the positioning of his goal that was so delightful.
Bill, you went for something more prosaic, I assume.
Well, a different kind of goal. Arsenal's second goal against Brighton, where Alexis Sanchez showed his genius. For most of the game, Arsenal were camped about 30 yards from Brighton's goal in the centre. Five of them trying to pass through seven Brighton defenders. Nobody allowed to pass the ball more than 5 yards. And on this occasion, it worked. Ramsey, first time pass. Sanchez took the ball, drew four Brighton opponents by running leftwards inside the penalty area. And he never looked, I've gone over the video, and he never looked to see where Iwobi was. But he just had this sense, I think, that given that four opponents were following him leftwards in the penalty area near the D, if he backheeled the ball, it's going to go into a lot of space, and there's a fair chance there'll be a colleague there. Sure enough, there was. Iwobi was there, and he finished.
Not many people know this, but Alexis Sanchez is, as you know, like he's three quarters human, one quarter bat. So he's got that weird sonar that extends in all directions. No, I loved Iwobi afterwards saying, like, he wasn't expecting the pass. He was just like, he's like, yeah, I had no idea. I had no idea it was coming. I still haven't worked out how he knew I was there. The Rafa Benitez derby at St. James's Park. Bill, I think you're very much a neutral in this game. For a team that plays the kind of football that Klopp plays, I thought it was kind of frustrating. Well, it must have been almost bittersweet that their one goal comes as a result of a brilliant individual strike, which really has nothing to do with the system or anything. Somebody shooting from there is a very low percentage shot. And then to add insult to injury, we go back and we talk about the defending, that really bizarre and frankly unlucky, because in the end, I mean, in real time, I thought it was, oh, look, Joselu's finished, and boy, Mignolet a fool again. But no, actually, it's Matip's recovery tackle that sends the ball off of Joselu, which sends it past the keeper. Klopp was unlucky. Was he?
Yeah.
Did he deserve to win the game?
Yes, he certainly deserved to win. I mean, he really...
So Rafa's a big fat fraud.
Really, if your team dominates like that and has far more chances, then it suggests you've got the game plan right. It's down to your forwards not finishing. I mean, all I can say is perhaps Liverpool, it's not the first time that's happened. They should just focus on finishing of their forwards, get into more psychology with the forwards in terms of getting the right frame of mind when they're getting fairly straightforward chances. The likes of Salah, he's had a good start at Liverpool, but he's missed a stack of chances, which could have added plenty of points for Liverpool. But this has been the case for a long time with Liverpool.
Alison, are you on board with that analysis?
No, I think something's going a bit wrong. It wasn't an aberration. The fact is, this is how Liverpool play all the time now.
But that goal was an aberration. And I actually kind of thought...
No, it wasn't an aberration, actually.
Oh?
No, because the it was a very... Let's give Newcastle credit. Shelvey's pass was excellent. The run was excellent. The defending was rubbish. How many times do you see people say,
no,
centre-back shouldn't be so far apart?
No, Alan, it's a defensive aberration from Liverpool. I know afterwards Klopp said, well, there were people in the way and they couldn't see him, that he was about to hit the... But no, then you see the replay. There's nobody in the way. You've got a very clear sight line. They're standing square, like two bowling pins, and he's directly between them.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
If they said, oh, let's give him as much space as we possibly can.
We're agreeing.
Yeah.
That, it's a combination of poor defence and good attack.
Yeah, okay, but... That is an well. What I'm getting at is it an aberration in the sense that both these two guys decided to go to sleep at the same time, or is this something that is a symptom of a manager who maybe doesn't
doesn't spend enough time working on defending, and because it should be second nature. This is just horrendous.
Well, let's compare Liverpool to City at the moment. Just at the moment,
yes.
If you look at the back line of City and the back line of Liverpool, they have similar shape, identity, mm-hmm. philosophy, and all the hard pressing work is done in the opposition's half of yes. the pitch. But City have upped their pressing this season and Liverpool have decreased it. So there isn't really that much going on. On the rare occasions that Newcastle did have possession, they weren't as distracted as Chelsea were, or whoever's playing against City are. You can't play that way defensively unless you're still going for the press full pelt. And they're not now. Liverpool are not. There was a very good piece in the Sunday Times, Jonathan Norcroft. All the stats are showing that Liverpool have backed off. Their intensity has dipped. So there's a contradiction there, isn't there? If you're going to give people like Shelby time to play a pass, why give him the route to goal? Because
this is Oselu, this isn't Hussein Bolt, and you expect Matip in a foot race to be able to handle a ball that's over the top, even if it's very accurate. But to be able to do that, he has to have his body positioning right, and he's got to be in the right position, and so does the other guy covering behind. If, on the other hand, these people switch off, and I know people make mistakes, and if you want to say it's an individual error, fine, everybody makes mistakes. But to have both of them in that situation,
fact is they're not that good. I mean,
it's a question of being awake.
But being good is about being awake as well. It's about having that concentration. I mean, defending is about concentration more than anything else, and that awareness of where the next threat's going to come from. If you could cherry pick from any team in the top six or seven or eight, which central defenders you might want, you probably wouldn't go to Liverpool to steal any of them, would you? I mean, they're not that good. And Klopp doesn't seem to think it matters very much.
I don't think they had to be that good to snuff out that possibility.
And this business with Liverpool's intensity and the press dropping off, I can't say good. When pressing teams work, all of a sudden it's like, oh, look, they're hunting in packs. They come up with these stupid things. We see the highlights. Oh, look, they're... It's one way to play, and no team actually presses for 90 minutes unless you're Borussia Dortmund and you insanely leave everybody up the pitch the whole time. And even then, you're not going to be able to maintain the same intensity because it's extremely tiring to do, unless at the same time you've got 70% possession, which City sometimes do have. I don't have a problem with Klopp dropping the intensity or pressing differently or pressing in different areas. I think that's a sign of maturity and evolution. And if I'm going to put Coutinho in my midfield, then I probably do need to do that. But I just can't fathom these mistakes again. And when Klopp comes out afterwards and says, well, you always talk about the bad things, so maybe it has an impact on my players. I'm like, what are they, babies? I mean, Dejan Lovren's a professional footballer. Dejan Lovren has been criticized for the bad parts in his game since he was in France. I think it was at Lyon, was it? Or Saint-Étienne, one of those clubs. Before he ever came to Southampton, right? He knows he's got these things to work on. That's fine. He works on them. You take the good with the bad. But I don't like being sold this notion that because we criticize them, then they play badly. I know. That doesn't make sense, does it, Alison?
No. Help me. I don't think Lovren reads the papers, to be quite honest. I just don't think he does.
Yeah, he probably gets criticism from Klopp, and then he's a professional footballer. Lovren doesn't get where Lovren got if he can't handle criticism, and he doesn't
exactly,
take it as a spur to do better. I want to just talk Rafa. All summer long, we've had this ongoing Rafa Ashley situation and spend more money, don't spend more money. If I were Mike Ashley, I appreciate Mike Ashley has apparently no friends in the media or among fans or whatever, but I'm going to try to turn myself into an Ashleyite. In fact, as Duncan Castles is to Mourinho, I will be to Mike Ashley for a minute, and I'll say, you know what, all you ungrateful Geordies and you ungrateful Rafa, you busted my chops all summer long, spend money, do this, back the manager, blah, blah, blah. You know what? I was proved right. I gave him the bare minimum he needed, and now he's in the top half of the table because he's a good manager who I hired, right? The new signings that I brought in, several of them haven't even played very much. I was proved right again, and I shouldn't listen to all you fans and so-called football journalists who are just hate me because I'm a Cockney. And is this Rafa, is this manipulative Rafa? More money, more spending. You had it at Liverpool. He's always wanting, net spend. Give me more money. I want more things. Same thing in Inter Milan. Give me this. Give me that. I need more, right? He does tend to, right? If I mean, why am I Ashley here?
Barely. I think he's been very restrained and contained, Rafa, actually. Because he was promised and not given more than he
promised
got.
Promised by who? Sorry. Did Mike Ashley go on television and say, I pledge that I will give Rafa £50 million in net spend to spend this summer? Did he say that?
No, I think the deal was, I wasn't privy to it, but the impression you get is that he stayed to see them through the promotion to the Premier League campaign on the basis that if he got them there, when he got them there, he would have money to spend. The carrot and stick. You're not going to spend a year in the Championship unless you think you're going to be allowed to at least do reasonably well in the Premier League when you get there.
I'm obviously playing devil's advocate here. But I think we should all be mindful of the fact that when these conversations happen, there's two parties. One is Rafa, one is Mike. And Rafa is the one who's more likely of the two to talk and tell you his version of events. Yes?
Yes. Mike Ashley obviously never talks to, doesn't seem to talk to anyone. He doesn't talk to the media, barely. He doesn't talk to Benitez, apparently. He hasn't spoken for 3 or 4 months. I don't know what the problem is. I mean, how he can't speak to the manager, why is he not doing that?
He doesn't want to be in charge anymore. He wants to sell it.
Just have a chat. I mean, just
he
ask.
He did offer him his helicopter when he had his hernia problem.
Newcastle's net spending has been reasonably high in the top 10 of the Premier League clubs, in terms of the transfer fees anyway.
It's been very low relative to the other promoted clubs.
Well, this goes back a few years, the spending is not too bad. I think he just made a few odd decisions, not least not speaking to his manager. It creates a feeling of instability. But there's this talk, of course, about possible takeover.
Good transition. Now, just to set this up, Amanda Staveley, everybody's second favorite blonde businesswoman, she was seen in the stands. And for people who don't know, she was involved with the Manchester City takeover back in the day. She's an advisor, I think is a good way to say it, to a fund in the Gulf. She also has a whole bunch of personal relationships with different uber wealthy people. She was long linked to be involved in the takeover of Liverpool. And you almost wonder, isn't it funny? Which Liverpool furiously denied, say the club's not for sale and blah, blah, blah. It's funny. She's there. People assume that she's taking over Newcastle. I wonder if she was there to, but whatever.
Maybe she'll buy them both.
How cool would it be if she bought them both and she merged them? Right? No, anyway. This is good for Newcastle, right? Since the fans don't like Ashley?
I think so. Newcastle has potential as a club. Throughout their history, they've been in the top 8 or 10 clubs for the highest average attendance. They've got the fan base there, which is the indicator for being a big club long term and gives you the potential for being successful. So they'd be a good club to invest in. For some reason, long term, they've underperformed. You have to go back to the 20s since they won the league and the 50s since they won a domestic cup. But around 15 years ago under Bobby Robson, they were getting regularly in the top 5. So I think with a decent amount of money, you could expect them to be part of the top 6, or it would be a top 7 if they joined it.
If you, Bill, were terribly rich and you want to buy a Premier League club, I'm struggling to think why you wouldn't buy Newcastle.
No, I think they're in a good position because
you don't have to build a new stadium.
They've got all the fans and they're quite stable now. Doesn't look like they're going to go down. With Benitez there, he's had the end of 2 seasons ago, the tail end of the season when they went down, and now the start of this season. They've had, I think it's 6 wins, 7 draws, 6 defeats. So that's kind of mid-table.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Delighted to be joined now by Duncan Alexander, who is the head of editorial content at Opta. You've written a book, Outside the Box. The subhead is A Statistical Journey Through the History of Football, which is, I'm always struck by how, like, there's a title which can go any which way, but then the publisher's always like, make sure the subhead tells us exactly what it is, and this is pretty much it.
Yeah.
I want to get a sense from you, though, before we get to the book itself and what's in it. Opta is actually younger than the Premier League, amazingly. 2002?
It's kind of had a few iterations. So it was formed in 96 by a marketing company who wanted to come up with an index, so to rank players, essentially, like they used to do in cricket in that era. And to do it, they had to analyse the games and record the data, and they did. And it was reasonably popular for a few months, but then people quickly realised that the actual raw data that went behind the index was more popular, more useful than the kind of essentially random number that was applied right. to it. So from then on, you know, the data existed, and as time's gone on, we've added more complexity and more depth to it.
This is a question I get asked a lot, and I have the opportunity to get an answer. How do you collect the data? Did you ever do it when you were, because it sounds frightfully boring.
Yeah, no, I've never done it.
Really? Not even when you were junior starting out?
No.
You just made the tea?
No, I kind of, my job's always been to kind of take that raw data and kind of fashion something out of it.
All right, so tell me about the drones that collect the raw data.
It's a pretty tough job. It takes them about 6 months to be trained and let loose. They collect around 2,000 bits of information per game. It's a combination of, obviously, human eye and computer software that we've built ourselves.
So you just said 2,000 bits of information?
Yeah, between two people, so roughly 1,000 each. So one for the home team, one for the away team.
Okay, so there's 90 minutes in a football match, and so that's 5,400 seconds?
About that, yeah.
And if they collect 1,000 points each, they're collecting one every 5.4 seconds.
Yeah. So if you think,
so nobody goes for a bathroom break. Do they wear those diapers like astronauts?
That would be revealing too much, but okay. Possibly. But they're the only people that love a really serious injury because they can actually just, you know, right. weep quietly for a few minutes before it kicks off again. But if you think they're collecting the start and end point of every event. So if a player passes, you know, if Barcelona are making a particularly intricate series of passes, that's two bits of information plus the type of pass. So three or four maybe per pass. You know, so you can quickly see how it ramps up during a game.
How do they collect the data? Do they have like special keys and stuff?
Yeah, so it's kind of we've kind of reconfigured a standard computer keyboard so they can, with their left hand, they type in like player shirt number and additional details, and then they use a mouse to basically track on a 2D image of a pitch, but they're transposing that from a 3D image of the game. So that's what probably takes them the longest time to work out, is the camera will always center on the ball pretty much when you're watching TV, but that isn't where it necessarily is on the pitch. So they have to think, right, the ball's actually in the corner, but my brain is saying it's in the middle. So that's what takes a long time to train, I think. If you think we're supplying professional clubs, we're providing bookmakers, you know, spread betting, we can't make errors. It has to be accurate. So again, that's why it takes a long time before someone's let loose.
And they do this off the box, right? Off television.
Yeah, we obviously have relationships.
It's impossible to do when it's...
We did an exhibition game in the summer for some people in the media and did that live at a ground, which taxed our analysts quite a lot because they were at the corner of the pitch.
Michael Cox scored, I believe.
He did, yeah.
Nice
quite a
finish.
Good little toe-poke finish, yeah. Generally it has to... I mean, we're official with a lot of leagues, so, you know, we can get, raw footage, which helps as well, so...
But if you don't have TV pictures, you can't...
no. do it, or it's
no. But the flip side to that is if there are TV pictures, we can do any game. So the chapter in the book is about the history of the World Cup. A few years ago, we went back and reanalyzed every World Cup from 1966 onwards, and basically because that's the first World Cup where every game was televised. So from every match in every World Cup from 1966 through to 2014, we have every pass, every shot, every tackle. So, you know, that means you can start comparing Pele with Maradona with Zidane. So, you know, it opens up, you know, pretty interesting data.
I often get angry and sometimes throw things at my television when people take some of your data, or maybe it's not your data, but it's data in general, totally out of context, where they'll be like, oh, look, so-and-so has a 92% passing percentage and so-and-so has a 90% passing percentage. Does it frustrate you because it's actually completely meaningless, that one number on its own?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we...
Like, you guys wouldn't put it out.
No,
we wouldn't. You're just given the raw data, and that's the easiest thing to spot.
You know, we sell data to people, and we...
People want to use it in stupid ways.
Yeah, we will advise, and we kind of... In many ways, our social media channels are a kind of way of curating that and kind of, you know, guiding people. Like, we've slowly managed to get people off the usage of Tackle Success over the last few years, because ultimately... Tackle Success in your head to the average fan, they think, you know, Bobby Moore sliding in and winning the ball, that's it. But actually, Tackle Success in the original definition was literally about who retained possession after the ball. So you can make an amazing tackle, but it goes to an opposition player. It's technically a tackle lost. So, you know, ultimately, that number was kind of being used a little bit wrongly. So, yeah, I mean, we will always kind of guide and hope to sort of lead and hope people follow. And I think, obviously, this season we'll have launched a range of new metrics, which hopefully, you know, are kind of the next generation of football data, really.
What are some of them?
So things like expected goals, expected assists, sequences. So if you think of, like, raw numbers, then you've got stats, you know, things like pass completion and stuff, and then it's the next kind of level on top of that, really, analytics. So we have a team of data scientists now who are building models, and there's a chapter in the book about the history of data, actually, and it looks at Charles Reap, who, obviously, you know, you can disagree with his conclusions, which were a bit awry, but you can't really knock his ambition to collect data. But what he was very limited by was, you know, it was literally him with a pencil and a notepad in a ground. You know, he couldn't scale it up. We now live in a world where we can scale up the collection of data, and we have the tools and the computer power to analyse that data in, you know, in much deeper ways and hopefully more insightful ways than ever before.
For those who are interested in this kind of thing, Jonathan Wilson does this massive takedown of Charles Reap in one of his books, where Charles Reap famously said, if Brazil passed the ball less, they'd be the best team in the world.
Yeah.
Or he thinks he miscounted something?
I managed to dig out a copy of some sports magazine from the early 60s that an old man on the south coast was selling, and it's got an article by Charles Reap in it. Basically, he starts off quite reasonable, and by the end, it's kind of a sort of proto-Brexit rant about, like, you know, overcomplicating the game.
Really?
And it's amazing.
This is in the book?
Yeah, it's in the book. It's some of the phraseologies just, you know, he basically just loses the plot towards the end and starts ranting about, you know, overcomplication and continental style.
He sort of counted the number of passes that preceded every goal. And what he found was that a huge amount of goals were scored with just one pass. But what he didn't take into account, that, you know, that was often after a period of pressure, somebody lost the ball in his own area, or say a corner kick, which gets flicked on. Oh, look, it's just one pass. That doesn't necessarily mean that passing is bad, right?
No.
That was one of his fallacies.
And again, it ultimately goes back to possibly a little, him being a bit dogmatic, but also the limits of what he could collect. All he could do was see what he could see with his eyes. You know, even now we've got a new metric called sequencing, which is basically looking at, a bit like in basketball, you take a point where a team starts a possession, and then when they end the possession, you know, you can extract that chunk and look at it. We've had that data for many years, but we have only recently been able to do it. Last season, Alexis Sanchez was involved in more sequences that led to a shot on goal than any other player in the Premier League, by quite a distance. You could never do that by the naked eye, and you couldn't even do it 5 years ago with the Opta data that it was hidden in. We're only now been able to kind of delve even deeper and extract that sort of stuff.
One thing, I mean, you mentioned before expected goals this year. They're on Match of the Day. Mm. I myself had a run-in a couple of years ago with Craig Burley over at Twitch. One of the difficulties with expected goals, I find, is explaining it in 30 seconds or less.
Yeah.
Do you want to have a go?
I think people get misled slightly with the phrase expected goals. They kind of imagine it's predicting something when actually it's obviously looking back at what what's happened. And it's basically kind of rating the quality of a chance. So we obviously have hundreds and thousands of shots in our database, each with a X and Y coordinate. So whenever someone takes a shot, we can compare that player and that outcome that he had with all the other ones in similar outcome with, you know, similar game state, and whether it was a header, whether it came from across, the set piece type, all that sort of thing. So you can basically build a probability model. You know, you can say 10,000 shots from this position, 5% of people scored it, but this player, when he is in that position, is better or worse. So it's actually a way of spotting runs of form or whether a player is good or not. And I think the key thing, again, it goes back to your point about the human eye and the knowledge of the game, is expected goals can shine a light on something, on how a player's playing, but you still have to make a judgment call on whether that player is doing better than expected because he's a good player, or whether it's just a sort of hot streak of form. So you look at someone like Messi, where he takes his shots from, the average player wouldn't score as many goals as Messi, and that, I'm pretty confident that's because Messi's very good at football. You look at Harry Kane, he's done it for the last three seasons, and you know, everyone said
he's overperformed expected goals.
Exactly. So one season wonder, and then two season wonder, and I think people have now, despite another goalless August, people are, you know, accept that he's a very good player. But you can then look at some players will overperform for a period. You know, Jamie Vardy in that run of games when he scored 11 games in a row. Some of those goals in that run, he could have hit many times and not scored. The kind of the vagaries of football will always kind of outwit science in some ways, because football is so random compared to other sports. We can shine a light on a lot of stuff, but you're never gonna solve football.
Getting back to the book itself, do you want to flag up some stuff that surprised you personally that you were not expecting? Because obviously you live this stuff every day.
Yeah. The kind of basic structure of the book is 25 years of the Premier League, so there's a kind of section on each season. So that was good, going back to the 90s and remembering. I mean, the thing that, going back through each of the seasons of the 90s, what people talk about now particularly is, you know, they worry about the Premier League becoming very polarised. Look in the sort of mid-90s, when it was least polarised, when the gap between the top and the bottom was smallest, you know, some of those seasons were pretty forgettable, like 96, 97 wasn't a classic. And then you obviously moved towards the 2000s with the Premier League teams, particularly the Big Four, were so defensively strong at that point, and that obviously translated into European success, which has, you know, vanished in this decade. But then it's not just about that. There's, as I mentioned, there's a chapter on the history of data, there's one on the why World Cups aren't entertaining anymore, and there's one on Liverpool going 27 years without winning the league, which, you know, statistically is unlikely. You know, every other big team plus, you know, if you had said to a Liverpool fan in 1990 Leeds are going to win the league before you, they'd have been a bit surprised. If you said Blackburn are going to do it, they'd be pretty surprised, especially if you said Kenny Dalglish was going to be their manager. And then if you said Leicester were going to do it, they'd have just walked out the room, I imagine. It kind of examines that. And then the flip to that is, obviously, there's a big thing on Arsene Wenger. No manager really has had his longevity with such a split in his career. You know, the first half, so successful, three league titles, you know, top two nearly every season, two European finals, and then since then. But the real killer stat, I think, on that is that if you look at his win percentage for both periods, it's almost exactly the same, to, you know, maybe one percentage point. So it's not like he's winning less.
Is that also not because, I don't know what year it was, but it was unusual for teams to get more than 80 points, and now you regularly have two, three teams a season getting 80 points?
That is the case. That's obviously what's behind it. And if you look last season, Arsenal's final points total, 75, would have been enough to win the league in the 90s. It's not that Wenger's kind of declined necessarily. It's that he came in with a massive competitive advantage, and he's kind of enjoyed that advantage and kind of stood still, and everyone's overtaken him, which happens in a lot of sports. But, you know, what's unusual is that he's still there, and it seems that the kind of issues that he faces are kind of there in perpetuity.
I'm interested in one thing you said that I hadn't really thought about, that English clubs a decade ago were more defensive, and at the same time they were successful in Europe. now they're more attacking. Are you talking about the top English clubs?
Yeah,
they're generally more rubbish in Europe. Are there numbers that bear this out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the three lowest scoring Premier League seasons were all, I think it was like 05, 06, 06, 07, 07, 08. It was kind of the Mourinho Benitez heyday.
And Arsenal in a Champions League final as well.
Yeah. I mean, there was that as well. England had at least one finalist for about 5 or 6 years in a row.
I find that interesting then. So, like, they've gone from that to Pochettino, Klopp, Pep, to being much more front foot. Also, because that's what other teams in Europe have done, and now they're not as good.
But I think this is where Bayern or Real or Barca, they know that they'll win 28, 30 games a season, come what may. The Premier League, it has become more competitive over the last few seasons. Mainly
how many games did Chelsea win last year?
30. Uh-huh. But the first English team to ever do that in a 38-game season. I mean, that was an anomaly.
Book Outside the Box, it's out now. I can buy this online. Yeah, I can buy this in
online. It's in all your favorite bookshops.
And if they don't have it, they'll order it from me.
They will.
There you go. Duncan Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for some quick hits. Arsenal win again, defeating Brighton 2-0. But Bill, did we write them off a little too early? You in particular?
Well, personally, I thought they'd finish fifth, and look at the table now, and they're fifth. So
they're not really fifth; they're fourth.
Fifth, according to the game this morning.
Okay. How many points do Arsenal have?
Well, joint.
Thank you.
Joint fourth on points, but then you've got this thing called goal difference.
Yeah, I don't believe in goal difference, especially when they've played different teams from the other team that are in fourth place. So there. Anyway.
Okay, they're joint fourth on points.
Thank you.
But there's no real change. They're playing the same style as ever. You could say they had a fantastic performance in drawing with away to Chelsea. They got a deserved draw there. But overall, you get these good runs of 5 or 6 wins in a row.
Sanchez and Ozil, who are two of their best players, have contributed very little thus far, right? Because of their different injuries and issues and weirdness, right?
Yeah, well,
You expect them to pick up the pace now that they're going to be fit and happy all season long.
Ozil, I wouldn't say he's nothing like a title-winning player. Not in Arsenal.
Yeah, how many World Cups have you won?
He's a top-four player. I'm not a top-four player. I accept that. But Sanchez is absolute genius, no doubt about it. And they're a great team. Okay. They're a member of the top six. They could certainly finish in the top four.
All right. Okay. Fine. No love for you, Gunnar. Sorry, not from him. Manchester United put 4 past Palace as Marouane Fellaini bags 2. Allison, want to show the large man with large hair some appreciation? Because Mourinho's come to love him.
Yeah, no, I've always liked Fellaini. He suffered from being too heavily associated with David Moyes. And
he suffered from being associated with the Rote Arbe Faction and the Bader-Meinhof gang in the 60s. Poor Moyes.
Yeah, a bit like that. He looks like he's a bit industrial, but he's not. He's actually a very effective and clever player. And when Mourinho decides he wants to show someone some love, it does matter. I mean, he can be so critical of players. You know, he decides they don't have the work ethic. He's getting rid of them. But he's decided to give some effort to building up Fellaini's confidence, and it has paid dividends. And now he's apparently, people are using the phrase, cult figure about him.
A cult figure who presumably will go back on the bench when Pogba's fit, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Burnley win at Everton, and weirdly, they have 8 points on the road and just 5 at home. Bill, any clever theories?
It's hard to work out why they're suddenly doing better away, given that the four teams they played have all been in the top 7. But one thing I would say is they just defend brilliantly. They pack the area around the D, and they're just prepared to block shots. Ben, me and James Tarkowski, they must get taken to the medical room after every game because they just get their bodies get battered by the ball, but they're just brilliant at blocking shots.
I'm wondering if you're giving into stereotype and image because it's the gravelly voiced one, right? If this was some fancy foreign manager, maybe with like glasses and a skinny tie, would you be saying it's a tactically brilliant defensive setup?
As opposed to they get their big centre halves in the way of the ball?
Firstly, I'm saying it is a tactically brilliant setup. Secondly, I'm saying it I'm simply looking at the figures. They've got the worst shots difference. That's shots by their opponents against them, minus their own shots. Their opponents have had about 85 shots more than they have. That's the worst in the Premier League this season, yet they're sixth in the table. And it was a similar story last season as well. Tactically, they get it right. They sit back and they block the shots.
Are they going to regress to the mean?
Well, it's quite a long term that they've been doing this, so I think you have to start saying that this is the mean.
Speaking of Everton, many fans are calling for Ronald Koeman's head. Alisson, he's your mate, although I suspect Henry might like him even more. Will you defend him?
I'm not sure I can, Gab. Not sure I can. I was in Italy when they played Atalanta, and I was genuinely shocked at how dreadful they were. And you all know I always keep a special eye out on Gylfi Sigurdsson. And to see the way in that game he was trying to orchestrate players, telling players where to run, where to be, how to defend, pointing at all the empty spaces and closing down that wasn't being done. It was an absolute mess. And that might well be the lowest point of the season for them. But Koeman is not weaving any magic in helping them to get out of it. He did some things that the fans wanted him to do and I wanted him to do against Burnley. He dropped Rooney because Rooney just gets in the way of Sigurdsson. They're trying to be exactly the same player and it's just a mess. He gave Calvert-Lewin time, brought Tom Davies on. But really, they're a team without pace. It's as though he's back in Holland or something. He's not playing in the Premier League. It's slightly bizarre how dreadful they are.
Sorry, Ronald. Hope you can bounce back soon. Only five teams in the Premier League have more points than Watford, who grab a late equaliser at West Brom through Richarlison. Bill, Harry Redknapp is surprised because he's come out and says, sure, couldn't name more than four or five of their players. Are you surprised?
I am surprised, given how many injuries they've had among their centre-backs. But you shouldn't really be surprised if you look what's happened in the last two seasons. This is the third season in the Premier League. Their strategy is get a new foreign manager in, have a huge turnover of players. And the first two seasons, they were in the top half on Boxing Day. And it looks like it could well happen again this season.
It's kind of hard to find a pattern there when they've had three different managers and they're three very different managers too, though, right?
I suppose with Marco Silva's case, he certainly made a difference with Hull. I think he improved them quite a bit halfway through last season. So you could say he's shown his abilities in the Premier League.
There you go, instant impact. You don't need time. It's just a lie that managers come up with. Tottenham are up to third after beating Huddersfield 4-0. September's over. Does it mean Harry Kane will stop scoring, Alisson?
Harry Kane will keep on scoring until the World Cup, which is in the summer. He doesn't like the summer. This is the irony of having an England striker who's hot, hot, hot. He doesn't like it when it's hot.
Well, he's English. Maybe the skin tone, the
maybe,
sunshine.
Maybe. Yeah. Mark my words, he will be phenomenal. And then in the World Cup finals, he'll struggle to find the back of the net.
I hope you're wrong, because the more I see him, the more likable I find him. Unlike Dele Alli, who, by the way, is a little bonus thing, that was kind of a stupid dive to take, right?
To be fair, he did look shamefaced afterwards. And even the opponents around him were going, never mind, Telly, maybe you'll dive better next time. Gab, I have a question for you. It's quite serious, actually. I saw a lot of online footage and TV footage of harrowing events in Barcelona. But football was part of it. Can you tell us what was going on?
Yeah, so this is a really complex issue, and if you care about it, I invite you, rather than making summary judgments, to go out there and educate yourself on the sides of this dispute. What I think most people can agree on is that it was just horrendous to watch police in riot gear behaving that way. And the reason it has to do, obviously, with the Catalan referendum, which was held, which, according to the Spanish government, was held illegally because it was unconstitutional. Barcelona as a football club obviously found themselves caught into it, because since the 1960s and probably even before that, they've been sort of a symbol of Catalan nationalism. They had to make a decision. Long and short of it is, as these scenes were going off all over the city, a lot of Barcelona supporters said, you must not play this game. One group of supporters says, if you play, we're going to invade the pitch.
So Barcelona's intention, and also to make a stand of protest against the heavy-handed policing, was to not play the game. And they asked for postponement. The Spanish league said, no, there's no reason to postpone this match. You will play this game. Depending who you believe, they were even willing to go and just simply refuse to play and take the points penalty. The players said, no, what was this points penalty nonsense? Let's play. And in the end, they found a compromise playing behind closed doors, and which was completely surreal in a 90,000-seat stadium. They ended up winning 3-0. Gerard Piqué, obviously strong Catalan nationalist, after the game was in tears. He's even offered to go and not play for Spain again if his presence creates problems. We talk about the separation of sport and politics. I frankly don't see how it could be separated here.
Hello, I'm Paddy Von Baer, and I'm here with Charlie Scott.
Hello there.
And together we are The Sweeper, the free fantasy Premier League tipping service from The Times. You can sign up at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, and you will have an email dropping in your inbox every Friday morning full of hints and tips, as well as access to our mini league and an eligibility for our monthly competitions and all the prizes that come with it.
This weekend was another fruitful one for The Sweeper. We tipped Harry Kane at Huddersfield, as I'm sure most people in the country did, so that's more of a must-have rather than a tip. But two goals for him in a 4-0 win brought 13 points for him. But the best tip that we had in Friday's email was probably Stephen Ward, the Burnley fullback, who registered an assist in their 1-0 win at Everton, and that picked him up 12 points, which was great. Elsewhere, Richarlison scored another goal for Watford in their 2-2 draw against West Brom. That's the second time this season that he scored after the 90th minute, and that was 10 points for him. And then Arsenal's defence, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we said, get on that bandwagon and get Hector Bellerin, Saad, Kolasinac or Nacho Monreal. The three of them between them have picked up 53 points in the last two game weeks, which, yeah, that's pretty nice returns there.
Heading into the international break now, of course, which means unfortunately no Premier League action next weekend, but there's much to consider, and as ever we've put together a weekend recap on the Timesport website, which features a couple of ideas of players to be bringing in, but also some advice on when to bring them in, which is not to rush into your transfers this week. As we know, plenty can happen during the international break and injuries can really sting you. In terms of the Timesport Mini League, it's Greg Saunders, aka FPL Fly, who is one of our pre-season experts, you might remember. So the cream is rising to the top as he scored 87 points this weekend after handing Kane the triple captain to move top of our mini league. And finally, of course, if you do sign up to The Sweeper at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, you'll be in with a chance of winning our competitions, and our September competition is live at the moment.
Still some tickets left for the Graham Souness Times Plus event in Glasgow, which is on October the 24th. To be in the mix for that, just sign up at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, and then in Friday's email you will get Paddy's teaser question.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Alison Rudd, The Return of Bill Edgar, and Duncan Alexander. Please do check out his book. I found it interesting, and even if you're turned off by this sort of thing, it's actually a really good read. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times online, and you can subscribe. You can access highlights for every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup from the third round, as well as all our excellent content. It's international break next week, but don't worry, we're going to be back next Monday when England will surely have booked their place at the World Cup in Russia. Till next time, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.